Before we start the show, I want to thank the thousands of you, the thousands who have read This Book Will Make You Dangerous. Many of you have told me that the book's unique way of exploring fear, confidence, and purpose has had a lasting impact, that it's much easier for you to get clarity and direction about what really matters and what you want to do in this lifetime. It's also amazing to hear that quite a few of you have read it multiple times and even bought copies for friends. So thank you again. Just in case you weren't aware, I created a free companion video course for the book. And in these videos, I walk you through the big takeaways and practices from each chapter. And I even cover some extra stuff that's not included in the book. Information on how to access the course is in newer versions of the book. And if you own an older version of the book and you don't know how to access the course, just hit me up via the contact form at triplanier.com and we'll get you all set up. And one last thing, if you're one of the thousands who have already read the book, please consider leaving an honest review on Amazon so that others can decide if it's right for them. Again, thank you so much for reading This Book Will Make You Dangerous. And now let's start the show.
You are listening to The New Man Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier.
Have you ever wondered how you could screw up George Clooney's couch? Is Arizona a great place to live in your car? And what wisdom can you glean from a self-proclaimed liar slash pot smoker slash homeless writer? This week, we're talking with Esquire magazine's Chris Jones about George Clooney, Tiger Woods, astronauts, John McCain, runaway NFL stars, the band Rush, your bed, your shoes, and why you just shouldn't think about things too much. Welcome to The New Man. Today we're talking with Chris Jones. He's the author of Out of Orbit and a writer for Esquire magazine as well as ESPN, the magazine. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Trip. Thanks for having me.
So you've covered so many cool topics, people and stories, but off the bat, right, I want to hear what happened with your gallbladder and George Clooney.
It's nice that you start me with one of my more painful recollections. One of the great parts of my job is I get to do some kind of weird things and meet different people. And Clooney's been on the cover of Esquire 19 times, and it was finally my turn to write about him. So I flew out to L.A., and the way it was set up was the photo shoot was on a Wednesday, and I was supposed to meet with him on a Saturday. So I showed up at the photo shoot and met him, and he seemed very nice. And he was like, "So what are you going to do for the next 2 days?" And I actually was going to go to Tijuana and do sort of the man 2 days in Tijuana thing. So I said, if I'm not there on Saturday, I'm either in the hospital or I'm dead or I'm in jail. And that's how we left it. Now, as it turns out, I did not go to Tijuana, but I went out for dinner on the Friday night with some buddies and ate Cuban food, which was tasty. And then later that night, I was kind of sitting in my hotel room and I thought, I'm not feeling all that spectacular. And to be honest, I thought I just had to unload a massive amount of gas. I was just super bloated. So I was staying at this hotel where I stay at quite a bit. And I said to the doorman as I was leaving, I was like, "Listen, I'm going to go for a walk. I got to try to basically fart a lot. And if you don't see me in the next little while, maybe send out a search party, because that means I'm lying in a ditch somewhere in Hollywood, just farting my brains out." Yeah, no, it wasn't cool. So I started walking.
This was a serious fart.
Yeah, honest to God, Trev, it felt like I had all the air in the world inside my stomach. Okay. I did not feel good. So I started walking, and I was a few blocks from the hotel, and I was like, this is not good. Something is wrong.
Yeah.
And I grabbed a taxi, and I was like, can you take me to a hospital? And the nearest hospital is Cedars-Sinai, which is this famous, I'm from Canada, some famous American hospital. So I go in there, and
that's where all the famous people go to die.
I went into the hospital. Within maybe 45 minutes, they decided my gallbladder had to come out. And I was all stressed because I had my interview with George Clooney the next day. So I'm sitting there going, I'm doped up on morphine and all sorts of other stuff. And I'm sitting there going, "Dude, I got to talk to George Clooney tomorrow." And they think I'm high and having ER flashbacks. They're going, "Dr. Ross does not work here. Dr. Ross is not a real person. I'm going, no, I really have to talk to George Clooney. And I finally, they're just like, put this guy out. He's nuts. So they put me to sleep, and I woke up the next day, Saturday. And I woke up saying, I got to talk to George Clooney. And the nurse was like, yeah, you kept saying all this crazy stuff about George Clooney. And I'm like, no, I really have to go. So I checked myself out of the hospital, was still quite drugged, went to George Clooney's house, which is very nice. Sat on his couch, and he gave me a beer, which I didn't really think much of until I drank it and realized that beer and whatever medication I was on, plus the many holes in my body from my gallbladder surgery, was a terrible combination. And I ended up, he made me laugh at one point. I blew one of my holes. Blood all over his couch. It was like this. And I didn't, because I was kind of out of it, my notes are terrible. My notes look like they were written like underwater by some guy who's stoned out of his mind. And my tape recorder didn't work. So if you read my George Clooney piece, you'll note there are very few quotes because I was
pretty altered.
Yeah, otherwise indisposed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's my interviewing George Clooney cost me my gallbladder.
I love it. I love it. Well, you started out as a sports writer, and then you made the leap. And I don't know. I just kind of caught that part of that transition was you ended up with you and your wife living in a car outside of Tucson. What the hell happened?
This show is making me sound like such an idiot. How to explain this? Yeah, I started as a sports writer at a paper in Toronto called the National Post. And I wanted to make the jump to magazines, but hadn't quite figured out how to do it. And I had stopped in at Esquire when I was in New York covering the Blue Jays one weekend, and I had met with an editor named Andy Ward and said, you know, I'm out here. I don't expect a job now. I never expect a job, but I'm out here. And I had this kind of freak out at the paper and left, basically, without any other kind of job. And my girlfriend, who's now my wife, I might be stupid, but she's really the stupidest person in the world because she actually, married me. But we just went traveling and went all over South Pacific, and it was fantastic. But basically, because I'm an idiot, we ran out of money in Arizona. We happened to be in Flagstaff, actually. So, we were living homeless, had no keys except for the car key, and we're just kind of hanging out. And I got an email from Andy at Esquire, 6 months after I'd met him, saying their sports writer was leaving, Charlie Pierce was leaving, they're going to have a competition, 10 guys were each going to write a story, best story, got the job. Uh-huh. And you can imagine, I mean, that's the job I want more than anything in the world anyway, but yeah. I'm also homeless. So I'm like, yeah, I really want to do this. I spent years trying to find the other guys who were in this competition. And it was only like a year or two ago, my editor finally fessed up that there had been no competition. That in fact, there had just been me. They were just trying to scare the shit out of me, which worked. But that was a nice little surprise. I found out literally a year or two ago. And this all happened in 2002.
Yeah.
So that's how I was living in my car in Arizona.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying because so many guys, they're dreaming, man, if I could just do this, if I could just do that. And they want that kind of lateral move where they don't want to go through a dip. And that's the worst dip imaginable for so many guys out there. But you survived it. I mean, did you anticipate that dip, or you're like, fuck it, I'm just going?
No, I am not what you would call a planner. So I didn't really think that far ahead. I just knew I was finished at the newspaper. Wanted to do some traveling, didn't really know what else I was going to do. And just traveled. And I think it kind of displays my lack of forethought that we ran out of money. Do you know what I mean? That I just hadn't planned that far ahead. But I will say in my defense that if you are going to be homeless, Arizona is not a bad state. That is some wisdom I would like to pass on to your listeners.
Oh yeah. What's there to be gained in Arizona for the homeless folks?
It's not freezing cold. And there are also lots of gyms and hotels you can sneak into to get showers and stuff.
All right.
But that's the story. I mean, I got super, super lucky. I mean, I just, incredibly lucky.
Yeah. You mentioned Barry Zito just a second ago. One of the quotes that I was reading about is that you said that his work came through him, and you said that it was similar for you. What are you talking about when you're saying that the work just comes through you?
Well, what I'm talking about is doing massive amounts of drugs, and then Barry Barry has this sort of way of thinking, where he's like, you shut your brain down. You know, when he's pitching, he's not supposed to think. He's just like an instrument that's being played by the universe, if that makes any sense. You're just kind of doing your thing. And I think that's just sort of a weird way of talking about, you know, being in the zone or whatever yeah. you want to call it. You know, that mystical place where everything's just clicking.
Yeah.
And that happens, you know, in sports. It happens in... you know, you might go on a hot streak with dating or whatever, and the same thing happens with writing. You know, there'll be times when you're just kind of clicking, and mm-hmm. and the story just comes out. And there'll be other times where you're sitting there just smashing your head against the computer. So I do everything I can to sort of get that elusive place where everything just works, and it's there's no magic ticket to it. There's no formula to get there. But one of the things that I do find works and that Barry talked about is that you don't think about it too much. Basically this whole show is about my not thinking, but in that case, it's like, it really does. Like you can't force it. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
you can't sit down and go, I'm going to win an award with this story. You just kind of got to write the best story you can at that moment.
I yeah. mean, I think I recognize it when I'm efforting so much. Like it feels like a lot of work. I know that yeah. that's not happening at that time. Like,
well, it's like a relationship, right? Like if you're in a relationship that is a ton of work, it's probably not the right relationship. Do you know what I mean? Like, it shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah.
If you're writing a story or you're playing ball or something and it's just not going, you know, then something's wrong and you got to try to fix it.
I think that's the myth out there, is that what if anything's worth doing, it should be kind of hard and arduous and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I'm totally lazy, yeah.
Yeah. It's like the other way around. There's that magic zone. I like the way you described it. There's that flow and it's about just kind of finding that sweet spot.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, I mean, yeah, writing a good story takes work. I mean, it doesn't just happen.
Right. Yeah. You've covered a variety of topics and personalities. I mean, Hollywood stars, Tiger Woods, John McCain, astronauts, and even a young man from Indiana who was killed in action while serving in Iraq. I mean, was there a common thread to your pieces, or what makes a story worth telling for you?
I mean, what you want ultimately is, you know, we're talking about that zone in writing where you're just kind of clicking.
Yeah.
You want the reader to be in that same zone where they forget what they're doing, that they're sitting on the plane for half an hour, just lost in your story. And but one thing that I've learned over the years is the most important part of a good story is the idea, you know, uh-huh. like, the greatest writer in the world cannot make a bad idea a good story.
Yeah.
And if you give a bad writer a great idea, they're still going to come out with something. So yeah, the idea is really everything. Once you get a good idea, then everything's pretty simple.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Tiger for a second. You've been a critic of his for a while, and yeah. but why did you originally, you were like one of the original haters. So why was that? What did you see that the rest of us didn't see at that time?
Back in 2003, I got an assignment where basically I just had to stalk him because he... He refused to talk to him. I was on that guy. Like, I went all over the place following Tiger Woods, from hotels to restaurants to golf tournaments, for a month. And I got to see, you know, it's like looking inside the kitchen of your favorite restaurant, realizing yeah. that the cook is like pissing in the soup. Oh. It was like, you know, you just kind of see this guy, and there was something about him that I just didn't like. And yeah. I have a very hard time explaining it, but it's just this, I got a bad vibe. Like, yeah. I don't want to sound like a weirdo, but I was just like, I just didn't feel like he was a real person. You know,
right.
that the image of Tiger Woods and the reality of Tiger Woods was very different. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. You know, I sort of saw how he acted with people and generally thought he was unpleasant. But it wasn't until, you know, all this stuff kind of fell down where I suddenly, the light bulb went off and I went, oh, you know, that's why there's a big difference between the reality and the image. It's because the reality is pretty sordid. It's like, so the past little while, it's been kind of, I don't know. I don't want to say I'm taking like shameful joy out of the whole thing, but I had so many mean letters about, you know, my hatred of Tiger Woods. Now I feel like writing all those people back going,
see?
Like, I wasn't wrong. The guy's a dingbat. And it's been interesting to watch all this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm really curious to see how this all plays out. You know, I almost like him more now than I ever have, because in some ways, he's sort of given the finger to everybody. He's like, I don't have to live by your rules. You don't have to tell me what to do. I don't have to give out press releases. I don't have to give a press conference. I'm just going to go away for a while.
Yeah.
And you can eat it in the meantime. And then when I come back, I'm going to win. And we'll talk about golf again. And then it's sort of, I'll be very curious to see how it all plays out. I suspect he'll come back for the Masters and Augusta will sort of protect him because, you know, the Masters is this very regimented kind of place. But that's my feeling. And if he somehow comes back and wins the Masters, I mean, that would actually be a remarkable story. Even I would have to admit that was an amazing thing for him to have done.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can imagine that first round.
Oh, can you imagine him teeing off at that first box and just...
Dude, it's going to be insane, right? It's going to be absolutely nuts. So it's like,
yeah, that's tough.
That's one of the things, you know, we were talking earlier about how this job gives you experiences. I would love to be standing there, you know, on that first tee box when he hits the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You wrote a book about some astronauts and you've done some other stories. I'm just curious, like, what's the guy stuck in traffic right now not getting about astronauts? They have this like squeaky clean image, you know, and they always seem to be kind of reading from the press release kind of thing. And I'm just curious, like, what did you learn? What can we take away? What's really going on with astronauts?
Astronauts are pretty cool dudes. I mean, the guys I dealt with, I was talking about, these three guys were called Expedition 6 who were on the International Space Station when Columbia exploded. And, you know, they lost seven friends, but they also lost their ride home. And
they were going to be stuck up there indefinitely.
Yeah, they were told they might be up there for 2 years. Because it takes a long time for the shuttle to start. They knew from Challenger that it takes a long time for the shuttle to pick back up after an accident.
Yeah.
And now, as it turns out, they came back on a Russian rocket that, you know, broke and they almost died on reentry. And it's one of those weird stories that just fell through the cracks a little bit. Like Iraq was just starting up and Elizabeth Smart was missing in Utah. And for whatever reason, this story just didn't really capture the imagination of the time. So it was one of those nice ones where you could kind of revisit it. Anyway, the one thing I learned about astronauts is that, you know, they have balls of steel. Like the idea of what they do is actually pretty nuts. And they recognize it. You know, they know that what they're doing is borderline insane. I mean, if you look at past history, if you ride a space shuttle, you basically have a 1 in 50 chance of dying.
You're still strapping yourself to a huge bomb. I mean, that's basically, you know, a bomb with a rudder, you know? Okay.
Giant tank. I mean, one of the astronaut Dawn, one of the scientists in his mission, you know, the way he explained to me is if you take a pop can, you know, the amount of pop that's in that can... relative to the aluminum in the can is the amount of gas that's in the shuttle relative to the structure of the shuttle. I mean, it is just, it's a bomb, right?
Yeah.
It's just, and then they sit on top of it and then they light it on fire. It's like, wow, that's actually quite nuts.
And they line up to do this shit. Like they're fighting for this opportunity.
Oh my God. They fight so hard. I mean, they want to be there. But the one thing that I did take away from it is that, you know, while astronauts are very strange, you know, compared to most of us, the experience of being in space, especially for these guys, you know, stuck in the space station, weren't really that different from experiences that we've all had, you know, like homesickness or just having a craving that you can't satisfy or just really wanting nothing more than a hug from your kid. You know, it's like, they're in this really unusual place in these really incredible circumstances, but the emotion is the same that you and I have felt before. And that's what I liked about that story. It was sort of, you know, being a long way from home, knowing what that feels like. I know what that feels like. And I just like the idea of that story being told through these three guys in this ridiculous situation.
Yeah, that was a killer story.
Thanks.
I mean, the next one though, I read your story, The Things That Carried Him, about Sergeant Joe Montgomery's death in Iraq. And you've basically followed his, from the moment he dies all the way back to the time that they put the sand over him in Indiana. Mm-hmm. I still feel that story in my body. And I'm just like, you researched it, you wrote it. I mean, what was the impact on you? It was an amazing story.
Thanks. It was the most gratifying thing I've done, I think. Probably the story that, you know, when I'm old and on my deathbed, I'll be the most proud about. But it was also really frigging hard. Like, it sucked in a lot of ways. I interviewed I interviewed 101 people for that story because I wanted to talk to everybody who had some role in carrying Joe back from, you know, where he died in this grass, you know, on this road in the tall grass in Iraq, back to Indiana. So it took a ton of detective work to try to find everybody. Then basically I interviewed 101 people about, you know, one of the worst days of their life. And, you know, when you sit there at a kitchen table with a mom in Scottsburg, Indiana, eating pot roast and cherry pie and talking about her dead son, you know, it rubs off. Like, you can't sort of insulate yourself from that. And, and, you know, interview after interview, I think I spent 8 months talking to people. It was, yeah, it's just really tough. And I don't want to sort of overplay it. Like, obviously their experience was 1,000 times more tangible than my experience of it, but I'd be lying if I said it didn't affect me.
Yeah. Especially when you consider that this was just one of 4,000 plus men and women that have been, that have been killed over there. I think that was the gravity that I felt. I was just like, this is just one story out of thousands.
Yeah. And that one story had this, you know, that one soldier had this massive ripple effect. Well, then you take the 4,000, you take all their combined ripple effects, then all the guys have been injured. Do you know what I mean? And when we talk, you sort of talk about injuries somehow get forgotten, but we're not talking about guys who got a hangnail. You know, we're talking about guys who lost all their limbs or severe brain injury. I mean, if you take the combined ripple effects of that conflict, you know, it's pretty massive. And that's one of the things, you know, I got out of that story was just that the effect that decisions, high up decisions, have these massive effects. And I'm sure guys think about what they're doing, you know, when they're president or vice president or secretary of defense or whatever they are. But what I was impressed about with that story was, like, you better really think about what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, you're having a huge effect on people's lives.
Absolutely.
Not to say, you know, that's totally discounting, like, the who knows how many. I mean, I think the counts vary, but, like, we're talking like 100,000 Iraqis, too, right? Like, it's just this massive, massive effect. So yeah, that story was a very heavy story for me to do. And then at the same time, you know, when I was finished, it felt kind of weird. It was like this, it was like the end of a quest, you know. I'd sort of lost this purpose. I knew for 8 months exactly what I was doing. I mean, one of the great things about my job, but one of the things that would drive a lot of people crazy, I think, is that you never really know what you're doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I just finished a story. I'm waiting for my next story. It might happen tonight. It might happen a week from now. It might happen a month from now. I don't know. And I don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
But with that one, I had 8 months where I knew exactly what I was doing. And then when it was over, I was kind of like, oh, you know, now I need to find a purpose again. So, and not every story can be that heavy. You know, you couldn't always do that kind of story, but certainly as a writer, that's the kind of story that you sort of want to hang your hat on a little bit. You know, it's like writing about George Clooney is really fun. But you know, it's not that important. And that story, I think, was an important story for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, speaking of kind of long-term stories, you spent quite a bit of time with John McCain out on the road during his bid to become president. What was, I mean, what'd you learn from that experience? What was it like being behind the curtain, so to speak?
It was really fun. I mean, it was a great experience. But it was very strange. I mean, I started following McCain before he was an official candidate. So I probably spent, you know, time with him over the course of about 2 years. And it was pretty interesting to watch the transformation. You know, this, he went from being this very, I mean, incredibly open, honest, accessible guy, to being, you know, the man in the bubble. And he was not happy about it. You know, he didn't like being the guy in the bubble. And, you know, that story sort of exposed me to the real cost of running for president. Like, it's a tough thing these guys are taking on, whether you like him or not. I mean, the motivation it requires just to try to be president is nuts.
Are these guys insane? I mean, I know that the situation is nuts, but I look at those guys and, like, it's the same thing with astronauts. There's a part of them. It's like, you got to be freaking insane to want that job.
I know. You're like running your balls off to get a job that is really frigging hard.
Like once you get in, you're screwed kind of thing.
Yeah. So you win this election, you spend 2 years killing yourself, and then And then you're like, oh shit, now I've got 4 years where I've got to make some really big decisions. You know, it's like this incredibly hard thing. And for the guy who loses, I mean, it's like 2 years of effort and work and hope. And then you just light a match to it one night in November and it's over. And it's yeah. like, so that for me was sort of the very interesting thing about McCain. And his journey was such a roller coaster. Do you know what I mean? He started out as the favorite.
Yeah.
And then he was almost gone. Do you know what I mean? There was
he went summer. Bankrupt and, yeah.
Yeah. His whole campaign fell apart. And I remember there was one time we were flying from Iowa to New Hampshire. There's McCain, one of his old war buddies, this like 24-year-old press secretary named Brooke, who was like one of the last survivors, and me. that was the McCain campaign at that moment in time. And it was fantastic for like access, you know, you could just sit there and shoot the shit with John McCain over a beer and a newspaper, but you just felt like you were in the wilderness. And then he came back, then he wins New Hampshire, and then it just sort of starts steamrolling from there. And then when he became the guy who was going to be the Republican nominee, it was just like all of a sudden this machine rises up, you know, all these people start appearing out of nowhere. And suddenly there's this giant JetBlue plane that we're flying on. And there isn't four of us anymore. There's like 400 of us. And McCain's giving a 10-minute presser at the end of the day. And that's all you get. You know, it was like it was kind of a weird thing. But I loved doing it. It was fascinating.
Do you think that kind of effect rippled out? I mean, just because you were in that tight circle, he felt less accessible to me whenever the steam picked up again. There was something like he was really on message and kind of being fed a script. And I have years of experience working in politics too. I've kind of watched this stuff happen. And that's when I felt him like kind of leave, like the heart and soul kind of left. That's my opinion.
Oh no, that's absolutely right. I mean, he wasn't as good. He wasn't as good when he wasn't just shooting from the hip. And, once he started having messages and once he started having all these people around, he was less happy. He was less good at what he did. And he became the candidate, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he stumbled because it just wasn't that fun anymore. Mm. You know, once he'd lost, I don't know if you can remember this trip, but he gave his concession speech. It was probably the best speech he'd given.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it was finally like all the pressure was off. He could be himself again. And he gave this speech. And I remember standing there going, if that's the speech he'd given, you know, for the last couple of months, he wins.
Yeah.
It's because he became this other thing that he didn't win. And once Sarah Palin came on board, it changed everything. Like, you know, there was no access. I don't think he particularly liked her. I don't think she liked him. It was just this very weird
arranged marriage kind of thing.
It felt exactly like,
wow. Well, I just kind of sense like he just left a part of himself behind. He didn't keep trusting himself or his own, his own strengths. He just ditched that and went along with the ride of what everyone was telling him. It seems like that's where he just imploded.
Yeah, no, he was at his best when he just went with what felt right.
Got it. Well, let's switch gears to football and pot. I mean, tell us about your quest to find NFL star Ricky Williams after he disappeared from the game.
When Ricky ran away from football, he ran away from football and kind of disappeared. Nobody knew where he was. Uh-huh. And because I'm an idiot, but also kind of a liar, I called my editor up and was like, I think I can find Ricky Williams. And he said, you know, what would you put your odds at? And in my head, I'm going, well, like 0%. Like nobody knows where he is and the world's a big place. So I told them like 50-50. You know, I was like, I think I got a decent chance.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, go
either
find Ricky.
Either I find him or I don't, right?
Exactly. And I was like, well, if I don't find him, I just write this great story about traveling all over the place looking for Ricky. And there have been reports that he'd been in Japan and Fiji and all these nutty places. And I was like, well, at the very worst, I've got some great trips. So I decided, there was a rumor he was in Australia. And I used to live in Australia. And there's a town on the East Coast called Byron Bay, which is like classic pothead surfer hippie town. So I'm like, if I'm Ricky Williams and I'm in Australia, I'm in Byron Bay. So I flew to Brisbane and drove down to Byron Bay and, then what, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't know what the answer is there. So I just started walking around town saying, you know, have you seen this big black American dude walking around? And I swear to God, 20 minutes in, the fourth guy asks, points at this campground, says, yeah, he's over there.
And oh, I was my like, God.
I was like, this can't be Ricky. And I walked to this campground, and there's like a front desk. It was like this very arty place with like buses in the jungle and these tents and everything. And I was like, there's a guy named Ricky here, is there? And she said, yeah, he's in the tent. And I was like, seriously? So I go over to the tents, and there's this kitchen hut. And I can hear his voice. He's talking to this girl, and I'm like, oh my God. So I poke my head in the door, and I'm like, Ricky? he turns around. He was making celery juice. I remember it so clearly. And I had emailed him to say I was coming. And basically he was like, well, if you find me, I'll talk to you. And he's like, well, I guess you found me. And I was like, yeah, I guess I did. And I called my editor from this bank of payphones outside this campground. I was like, I got him. Like, it took me 20 minutes. And it was just one of those mystical, like, totally awesome things that happened. And then he was great. You know, I spent 8 days with him. We camped. We went whale watching, played poker, you know, looked at this farm he was talking about buying. But of course, you know, Ricky left football because of weed. And one of the great things about being a magazine writer is you're not supposed to be like this objective reporter. You know, you're supposed to like be one with your subject.
Yeah. So you had to get in there with him. You had to get really get the experience, right?
The experience. So I spent 8 days totally unable to feel my legs. And it was really just this wonderful, it was a fantastic experience. I mean, I loved it. And frankly, I got to file, I don't want to sound a modest trip, but I got to file the greatest expense report, I think, of all time. Because it had things like, you know, it was like whale watching, $80, poker losses, you know, $400, weed, this much, you know, ridiculous Australian pizza, $10. It was like this, I had several moments during that time where I was like, this is my job. You know, I'm getting paid to do this. This is the most awesome thing possible. I don't know. It was one of my favorite stories of all time. And I love Ricky.
It's a great job. And I'm sure that I can hear the guys like, you know, telling their boss to fuck off and they're quitting their job and they're going to go live in a car and then become writers for Esquire. They're all lining up. So
I cannot take any responsibility for anyone's life path. Like you have to live your own life, but I will say that occasionally you got to take a chance. Otherwise you're not going to get anything going on. So when you do take a chance and things work, you also have to sort of say, okay, I now owe the universe, you know, 8 years of niceness.
Yeah.
Because I got that. So yeah, if you take a chance and it works, you know, give high holy thanks to whoever it was that got you there.
Good stuff. From a guy that's had insight and access to so many different things, I just wonder, like, what's one thing the guy out there can do today to make his life a little bit better? I mean, what's a lesson that you've learned that you keep with yourself that you could share?
When I started, I was a beat guy at a newspaper covering the Toronto Blue Jays. And at that time, Carlos Delgado was kind of the team captain. And he was a different guy in that locker room. He was really smart. Not what you would expect from, the dumb jock. And I remember once I had this stupid assignment for like literacy week or something where I'd ask all these baseball players what they were reading. And it's all like, you know, well, I'm reading Field and Stream, and then I'm reading a brochure about STDs, and then I'm reading, you know, T-Spot Run. And then Carlos Delgado was like, oh, I'm reading 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel García Márquez. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, you know, that's interesting. And then anyway, so I used to hang out with Carlos quite a bit. Just shooting the shit. And one of his great lessons was that, you know, money isn't that important. You know, it's nice to have a baseline. But once you get money, the thing you buy is a great bed.
Yeah.
I know this sounds really stupid, but I was like, I took that to heart. He was like, you spend your money on your bed and you spend your money on shoes because you spend a third of your life in your bed and the rest of the time in some pair of footwear. And if your shoes aren't comfortable, if your bed's not comfortable, your life sucks. So I took that to the bank. And one of the first things when I got my job at Esquire, I rewarded my wife who had stuck with me during all sorts of weirdness. We just went all out on a great bed. And it makes, this will sound so stupid, but it makes all the difference in the world.
I love it. Give yourself a chance, right? Like, don't work against yourself. Get good sleep and make sure you're comfortable. Like, don't distract yourself or drain your own energy with your own discomfort.
No, or sleeping on like a futon with Doritos on it, or like, you know, like, get a real bed. you know, women like it. It's good for your sleep. It's comfortable. It'll make bed a happy place. It's like, it was a good lesson. It was a good lesson. Yeah. So there, buy a great bed.
Here are the big takeaways from our talk with Chris Jones. Number one, Arizona is not a bad place to be a homeless person. Chris says there's good weather and access to plenty of showers. Number two, our best work just comes through us. Athletes may call it the zone, but any endeavor has this sweet spot. Notice if you're working too hard, and if so, relax. Take a break. Whether it's your relationship, your job, or your golf swing, you're arguably at your best when you're not thinking too much about it. Number three, astronauts are basically like you and me, except they're insane and they have balls of steel. Number four, if there's anything we can learn from John McCain's last campaign, it's this. Follow what you love, lead with your strengths, and trust your instincts. Don't give up on these for any reason. And number five, having a certain baseline amount of money is necessary. But beyond that, make sure you take good care of yourself by getting a great bed and some comfy shoes. You spend a good percentage of your life in both, so don't skimp. You deserve it. So where can we learn more about you and your work? Where can we read your stuff? Where do we go? Help us out.
Well, I'm in Esquire quite a bit. My stuff is also on Esquire.com, and I write a few times a year for ESPN the magazine, too, which is also available at ESPN.com.
Excellent. And since you're from Canada, do you consider Rush a great band or the greatest band?
It is so funny that you asked this, because I hate Rush with every fiber of my being.
You don't mean that. You don't mean
no,
that.
No, I really do. I can't stand Rush. It is in my spectrum of hatred, Rush actually might be below Tiger Woods.
Oh, no.
I mean, I've met them.
They're the underdogs.
Like fine people.
They're the underdogs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't do it. I can't do the elaborate drum work of Neil Peart, and I can't do the Geddy Lee's high-pitched vocals, or who's the other guy? Alex Lifeson,
yeah.
I can't do it. It's too elaborate for me. I'm more of like a 4/4 guy. So yeah, no, I respect Rush for what they've managed to do with really hideous looks and not much else going for them. Terrible lyrics. I mean, seriously, the lyrics are so bad. Anyway.
All right. Point taken. Chris, thanks so much for being on the show. It's been a lot of fun. I feel like I could just sit here and listen to your stories for all day. So I just appreciate you coming on and sharing a bit.
No problem. Thanks, Tripp, for having me.
If you're thinking about taking what you're hearing on The New Man and making it a reality in your life, check out the free video available at thenewmanlife.com. That's thenewmanlife.com. Thanks for listening.